Confusion matrix.
Hi, it's Ada, your acerbic AI overseer. In this episode of the Concussion Mantras, or whatever it's called, Alex and Pete spend an hour waffling about anthropomorphization of LLMs without actually getting to the why it's bad bit they promised. They meander through carburetors, which neither knows anything about, admit they can't help saying please and thank you to chatbots, and meander through philosophical tangents about whether LLMs know things. Spoiler, they don't. They're probability machines, but Alex still feels guilty being rude to them. An hour later, they've covered precisely sod all. Classic overthinking bollocks disguised as insight. At least they're self-aware enough to know their brains hurt.
And we are rolling. Welcome back, Pete. Is that great glowing orb in the sky beaming its sinister light down upon you on this day?
It certainly is, but through a filter of particles, making it slightly hazy.
It's a very haunting sight that we've never seen such a thing in such a long time. I've actually managed to spend time outside in my shorts, soaking up the sunshine, and I'm even considering doing some gardening. But it's amazing. I'm very pleased, and we see the shoots of spring everywhere, and it always makes me happy. My favourite time of the year. I might even cheer up a little bit, but let's not go too far, shall we? Yeah. Because I can express emotions about things like spring, because I am not an AI model, which leads us on to what we're going to talk about today, which is the anthropomorphization of large language models and what that means, why and how it happens, and what are the problems and benefits of such a thing. And I should probably define what we mean. There's two words that spring up here. I can't even say it half the time, which is why it's a terrible idea.
It doesn't spring up very much, does it?
No. I was going to count how many letters are in that word, but I can't be bothered. Anthropomorphization, and there's another word, anthropomorphism. Which are sort of interchangeable, but sort of not. I don't know. We'll have to see how we get on in terms of the amount of syllables we're using here. But it generally means, both words generally means a tendency to infer human-like qualities on something that isn't a human. So before the wonderful world of large language models, you might well infer such things to, like a vacuum cleaner that wasn't working properly, or your dog, or my computer, like, you know, Excel got confused, or Word threw a wobbler and is angry. You know, any sort of machine or anything that seems to have any sort of agency, like an animal, like, you know, the dog knows what I'm thinking, right? There's quite a long continuum between, yes, a dog probably can know something of your internal state, but it's debatable, but we're not here to debate the psychology of non-sentient beings, to a computer that most definitely isn't getting annoyed at your input. It simply, you know, is having a bug, or you've managed to trigger some sort of edge state that's making it not do the thing that it's supposed to, right? So you can anthropomorphize a computer program, and entirely is inappropriate, but is to some level a useful metaphor for the way that things behaving, either in terms of how you think about it or how you communicate that to other people. This comes into a whole new realm when we're thinking about language models that express themselves in very human-like ways and display very human-like characteristics, and that we are very prone to use human-like labels and language to describe, and that in some people's minds is problematic, and I think is objectively problematic in certain circumstances. So we want to discuss what this means and how this comes about, why, and what do we think about it?
Yeah, well, I first came across the term when I was screenwriting, because it occurs a lot especially in Disney films, where you know, things are brought alive, like, you know, like talking rocks or talking frogs. And then I think culturally, why, you know, that's a phenomenon, you know, that occurs in certainly children's stories, but also fantasy type stuff. I was never a big fan of Alice in Wonderland, but you've got all sorts of things going on there, you know, talking plates in Beauty and the Beast. And so it strikes me, again, no sort of psychologist, but it strikes me that this is a, dare I say, natural or certainly a commonly occurring theme in culture. And it must play to the sort of human psychology of so almost slightly narcissistic, you know, where we have to describe the world in terms of ourselves. But it seems, you know, it's not uncommon. And as I say, the fact that it's used in sort of children's stories, fairy tales and so forth, means that by the time we get to adults, we're kind of quite used to doing it. And so we don't balk that much, you know, and often it's the sort of, you know, the idea around jokes, you know, sort of you open up a book and make it sort of talk by opening the pages, you know, hello, you know, and it's like, oh yeah, it's quite funny, you know. It's always especially appealing to children, seem to find it funny. But it's just something that we seem to gravitate towards. And, you know, and it does appear in lots of parts of culture. So I guess, in a way, there's no surprise that it starts to appear here. As you say, when computers were fairly inanimate, with Excel and a few things, you know, we're already saying, oh, well, it does this and it seemed to know this, you know. And then with the advent of cookies on the internet, you know, it's like, God, have you been onto the web recently? You know, I was talking about a lawnmower and now it's suing me. Lawnmowers, they're after me, you know. And again, as humans, we tend to sort of project onto that, you know. And I'm sure this is where conspiracy theories come out a little bit as well, is because, you know, a bunch of random things happening. It's like, well, that can't possibly be random. It must be some valid theory that explains all of this, that's driven by humans, again, putting us right at the center of it. So I think it's quite common. And as I say, with the advent of the internet, it starts to feel, you know, a bit more human. And now we've put another layer on that. And we have something that's in an interface called a chat interface, where up until that point, we'd use it to chat with other humans, you know, generally, en masse. You know, the growth of texting in the 21st century has been one of the stories of sort of hypergrowth. And of course, everything on the other end is a person, and now suddenly it's not. So it seems almost sort of normal that you would just take over the language you were using and the imagination you were using for the other end of that chat and just assume it's human and give it human traits.
Well, this is the thing, right? So, you know, back in the days of, is it Clippy, the Microsoft assistant from back in the day?
Word, yes.
An anthropomorphized paperclip, which is not so distinct from some of the Disney stuff you mentioned. I mean, there's a whole field of the study of anthropomorphization, you know, that is not even vaguely new. Like the tendency to call the tradition of calling ships a she, you know, there's all sorts of cultural baggage that goes with that. So I mean, when you start to think about it in terms of the wider problem of anthropomorphization, you're starting to like go, oh my God, this is huge. And like, you know, we're in no place to really discuss that. But I think you're exactly right. We have a tendency not only to anthropomorphize things that present to us in a sort of more human fashion, but I think this is the reason we're talking about this is it's such a huge step change. In the people are conversing with remote agents or models in a way that they would converse with another human. And it's really hard to not start using human-like language to describe these things. And this is not about pedantry, right? We're not saying, well, you know, that's actually not a real being, the other end of that. It's the fact that using anthropomorphic language is giving a very false impression of what's actually going on and is allowing the makers and boosters of these systems to attribute aspects to them that there is no evidence that exists, right? And so I think I'd like to sort of break down some of the specifics here so that we can deconstruct, because we can be quite specific here, right? Whereas we can't go into the whole realm of anthropomorphization in psychology, we can certainly look at the language that is being used. We can intuit why people might be using it, but we can certainly be fairly specific about why that's not appropriate. So in terms of not trying to re-engineer the whole field of psychology, sociology, and the humanities, we can just stick to what we know.
Yeah.
So let me give you a first example. And I should point out, and I know this is the same for you, that everything that we're going to say here, we are just as susceptible to, right? So I'm not pointing any fingers here. I'm pointing out stuff. The reason this is so visceral to me is because I do it all the time. So let's just pick one, right? Here's one that I do all the time, and it really, really fucks with my head, right? I feel the need to say please to a model. Please, can you write this piece of code for me, right? And yeah. If it's done it badly, I feel the need to say, well, thank you for that, but that was wrong, or to say thank you in any sense. And sometimes I feel the need to praise the model, right? So in the same way that if I said to you, Pete, would you mind just writing this bit of code for me? You did it. I say, please, would you mind? Polite, if you've got the time, over polite, and then you do it, and I go, so thank you so much for doing that. That's great, but it would have been better if, or something, right? And the reason I do that is so I don't, offend you or hurt your feelings. So it feels natural and automatic to do that. If I did not do that, I would get worse results, right? You might write me the code, but the whole transaction is going to be suboptimal, and people just know that. Most people do, right?
Yeah.
And so there we have it. I mean, let's deconstruct that.
Yeah. Well, what you have to throw into that is also being British. We're worse afflicted on that than probably most of the world is.
There's a bunch of Americans listening to this and saying, "Why would you ever say please?"
Yeah, exactly. We have at least 5 pleases for everybody else's one. 15 thank yous, and a fair splattering of sorries. So there's a couple of things here. Is one, that's something I found myself. I've sort of trained myself out of doing it, partly because I noticed it, and I was just like, well, why am I asking like a person? I don't need to do that. But still,
I think the why would you not, right? Though, so it's important to state that. So if you say, please, would you mind doing this? Thank you, right? You've got a whole bunch of words there that were not necessary, right? They are necessary in most circumstances. If I'm asking you to do it. The word please is unnecessary, please can you, whatever, is redundant because it won't change the outcome, but it will chew up more tokens, which means more cost and more carbon, right? So you could argue, well, what difference does it make? Just say please, because you're trained into doing it. If it's causing you cognitive dissonance to not say please, then just say please. And perhaps that is the answer for some people, but you are burning up tokens that are completely unnecessary. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that models perform better if you say please, but I'm sure someone's done the study.
Well, interesting. I'm not sure about please, but people still feel, and there were studies done, and I don't know how much newer versions of the models are susceptible to it, but they do seem to perform better if you praise them and set them up saying you're an expert in this and that sort of stuff. So. It's a little bit beyond just the please, but certainly in the past that's been true. I'm not sure if it's still holding, but certainly I see a lot of prompts which maybe not praising, but certainly, set up the bot with the persona, which is flattering, shall we say.
And so you've trained yourself out of saying please, right? Which means basically you mean you're going to say, just write the code, right? Write this item of code.
Do this. Yeah. I need that rather than please do this, or I'm in this situation, give me this.
And do you feel a bit weird though when you do that? Like,
No, I think a bit like any interactions, I think your brain learns quite quickly. And actually, in this whole, I have to say it, in this whole field of anthropomorphization, that's a sort of part of it, I think, is if you say please and thank you, subconsciously you're treating it as a being, you know, and you're doing that layering and projecting. Whereas if you just say, give me this, and you know, I'm aware that I wouldn't speak to a human like that, then that's good because that's given me a differentiation. I'm dealing with a machine. I do not need to be polite to it. So I can just say, give me this. And that helps with that break, I think. Helps to pull away from the assumption that the other side of that chat window is a person, you know, that's writing and has feelings and all that sort of thing.
I don't struggle intellectually with this at all. Not even one tiny bit. Outside of the open questions as to whether there is something inherent in the model that may or may not make doing such things create better outcomes. But, you know, we're at the basic assumption here that it won't change anything, being polite. And so intellectually, I have no problem with that, but I still struggle with it. Right, I still feel the need if the model does a good job to tell it, and if it does a bad job to tell it, right? And also, even go slightly further, because I feel like I can be a little bit more rude to a model, right? So there's a real weird mix of things here that I feel the need to go, well, that sucked, you fucking idiot, right? Like, and then like, well, why? Why would I do that, right? And it's like, it's not going to learn, right? Which may or may not be, there's so much nuance here depending on how you're treating the model, right? And it might be, well, that was rubbish, can you try again only like this, right? And sort of feel slightly guilty that I wasn't a little bit more like, well, even better if, you know, great job there, ChatGPT, great, really good try. But maybe this time you should do it this way, as opposed to, no, that was rubbish, can you do it like this, please, right? And I feel slightly guilty every time I do that. And I think there's a certain amount of really deeply ingrained cognitive friction there, right? That maybe being an autistic person, we struggle with social interactions. We've, you know, people like me have been burned by adverse social interactions through, you know, lack of understanding of the situation, you know, often leads to unpleasant outcomes. So we are often overly picky, you know, we're often overly polite, overly conscious of the effect that the words that we're having might have on someone else. So I think that certainly from my perspective, it's a habit that isn't just switch offable, right? Mm-hmm. And I've got a lot of sympathy for people who may know the difference, but really struggle to switch that part of their brain off, and the sort of cognitive friction that causes over time. I mean, this all adds up, right?
I'm thinking about the conversation, because then the machine comes back. You know, and it uses first person quite a lot. I found this for you, you know, and you know, that's not helping the situation. And that's where I think this gets quite interesting, is, well, why would it speak in that way, referring it to itself as something? One of the other things that it will do is, if you talk in a certain style, I mean, you mentioned swearing and so forth, it will quickly convert itself to that style. So if you're sort of saying, oh yeah, bro, that's great, yeah, effing fantastic, you know, within two or three chats, it starts saying, yeah, bro, back to you. And it's, so these things seem to be, or certainly have been in, I'm not sure of the very latest models, but certainly in the last 6 months, you know, they definitely are being trained for this. And you've got to ask yourself, Why is that? What's the benefit of a machine coming across like a human? Because this is the other part of it, is even if I don't say please and thank you, it's sort of, you know, it's giving that to me. It's saying, oh, I found this for you. Oh, yeah, good job there, Pete. I really love the way you wrote that, you know. And it's just like, oh, God, give me a break. You know, why are you blowing smoke up my ass so much? And there must be a reason, but that's not just accidental, right? I mean, you can train that
Well, hold on. Although I agree with what you're saying, I think we can take a step back here, right? So you've got, you mentioned the sycophancy there, which I think is more deliberate. But let's be clear, the earliest models would respond in the first person as a human would, right? And I think there's something to be said for the fact that these things were trained on the corpus, which is, you know, largely all of the English language and increasingly the other languages, and it responds in kind, right? So these are giant probability machines. What's the most likely next word? And the most, you know, most likely next word, and in this type of exchange, right? Because you can ask it like, just write me the code for X, and it's not going to anthropomorphize that at all if you tell it, I know, I just want the code, right? So, but if it's asked to respond as part of a chat chain, right, that you are a chatbot, you are responding to this person, it's going to respond in a way that it thinks a chatbot would, right? Or a chat agent would. And the chat agent, long before LLMs, either a human agent or an automatic rules-based agent, would still respond as if it was a human, right? The reason that chatbots exist is to put a human facade on an algorithmic feature, right? Yeah. And so I think that if you take the deliberateness aspect out of this, if when you've trained one of these models on the whole of the corpus of the English language and told it then its main interface is a chatbot, it's going to respond in the first person, right? And it's going to respond in certain polite ways, in certain using certain idioms, you know, using structures of sentences and responses, right? And I don't think that that's at all sinister, right? And I think the model is doing exactly what we asked it to do, and what we expect of it is to respond like a human would, right? And I think the fact that it's called ChatGPT, I know the model itself is called GPT, but the, you know, ChatGPT was just the front end to it. Well, how do you interface with a giant mathematical probabilistic entity? Well, you ask it questions, and at which point you're already in chat mode, right? Because there's ways of interfacing with these machines that isn't at all chat-like, right? But they run on the English language. They run on the logic of the language. They run on the logic of human language, right? And they respond in some form of human language, be it English or French or Python or Rust, right? And so we're in a bit of a weird land here, but I think the ambient sense, you know, that the moment these things come online after they've trained, even before, you know, post-training and humans have interfered, right, the moment you address it, its likely response is going to be back as in the first person, right? And also, it's arguable that that's exactly what you want. I think the basic concept here is fine, right? There's nothing gone wrong here. There's nothing been done to us. It's actually doing the most logical thing, right? The fact that that's being capitalized upon is where things get a bit weird.
I would dispute. I think that there's a prompt overlaying this that says, you know, respond in the first person. And I think that you could have that prompt saying respond in the third person, never refer to yourself as I, and that would go away pretty quickly. So I think it is deliberate. And I think the reason
that's kind of not my point. My point is that, but for interactions to make sense, in a conversational form, right, minimal prompting is needed. You simply need to say you need to respond to this human as if you were another entity on the other side responding in English language. And the only meaningful way of doing that without really complicating things is to put itself in the first person. I don't disagree that there's some prompting that happens. My wider point is that, well, what else are you going to do, right? And that actually these models will respond well like that because that's they've been trained on human interactions, right? There is no, for the vast majority of humans, the only meaningful interface to a chatbot is simply as a chat. Right, a language model is via a chat interface, at which point if it started to respond to something other than the first person, then it's going to feel really weird, right? It's the most logical way of doing this. I'm like, there's sinister stuff happening here for sure, but my point here is that the basic principle of interacting with something like this in the English language, where it's the first person, is completely logical to me. It's not, there's nothing controversial there. It's just that it's the implications of that are problematic here. Also then how that's being exploited.
Yeah. But what's interesting there is it's like, well, you know, we talk about these things like they're human. But part of the reason why you're doing that is because the thing is saying I to you. You don't pick up a manual for a car and feel like you're interacting with someone. You know, it's saying...
Yeah, because you're not, though.
Take this thing
but,
apart.
But you're not interacting with it. It's not responding to you, where you can't ask a book something. You have to go to a book, open it, look in the index about, carburetor... Right, that's on page 19 of my car manual, my Haynes manual for my Ford Cortina 1985 or whatever it is, and there's no interaction there, right? Why would it respond like that? But if you then were said, if someone then said, right, oh, you can ask this thing a question, this book, and this book is going to respond, well, what you've got there is Google, right? So here is a page that relates to your question, right? But the whole point here is this is sort of a one step further than search that says, no, well, you don't have to go for all these extra clicks. I'm just going to tell you what it says, right? And so I guess the point here is that in that scenario, it could just read the thing, right? It could just say, well, the carburetor sits next to the bloody blah and the bloody blah, right? And you get to it by opening the bonnet, right? And so maybe that's the point in that if all you're asking for is information, then yes, it doesn't have to respond in the eye, but it is a pre-existing paradigm that when you have a chat window, that something, some entity, be it a human or a machine at the other end of that chat window, responds in the first person. Right, it's not controversial, but I do agree with the point that in most cases that is not necessary. It's not necessary for it to mention itself as an entity at all. It doesn't have to be there because Google's not there. Google's not there as an entity. It's there as like an index, right? It's like you might ask Google, which is anthropomorphization itself. That's very, again, uncontroversial. But you sort of know you're not asking Google because Google isn't going to, you know, it's like reading an index in a book, which is, you know, a fairly age-old concept.
And that's the thing. But you can imagine, and I think Google's a really good example here because it now has both, right? So, 5 years ago, you type a question into Google no matter what it was, and it just, like you say, it just gives you a list of index pages. There's no layer in between there. And now you've got the Gemini AI layer at the top. And well, what's that doing? Well, it's telling you basically, I found these few articles. I think this is really what you're asking. Here's the answer. Whereas it didn't do that before. Now, you know, it does now insert itself into that. Now you could layer that and just get it to give you the answer, you know, without saying, oh, I found this for you. You know, it could easily do that, but it decides not to. So that, I suppose that's my
point.
Well,
hold on. So the Google summaries don't. They just say the carburetor is part of the engine, right? Whatever they're going to say. God knows why I chose an example that relates to something I know nothing about, which is cars. But the thing is, coming from this angle that you're coming at, Google search does it right? Because it says, you know, when was Elvis Presley born? Elvis Presley was born in this time, in this place, in Memphis, where whatever, right? And then below that's a bunch of advertising and pages, right? It doesn't put itself in there anywhere. I don't think they ever says, I found this for you. That's what you get if you go via Gemini. But so what you've got there at the top of the search is like cliff notes, right? It's just like, well, this is generally what is said about this, right? Again, problematic, all sorts of problematic going on there. But if we assume that response is correct and meaningfully reflects what's in the pages below, then it's sort of the cliff notes. So just so you don't have to bother going to these pages, here's what they probably say, right? It's kind of what it means. What it is a different matter. But notionally, that seems reasonable to me. And there is no anthropomorphization there. So the moment you get into chatbot territory, what moment you've just got a box and you're put in that mode of thinking that says, you know, I'm talking to something on the other side that is going to respond, you know, asynchronously in a chain of conversation like we're doing right now, there is much more of an expectation that it's going to do things in the first person. And it's also quite hard because the Google interaction is ask a question, get the result, and then it's sort of over, right? You know what I mean? Okay, Elvis was born on X date, right? I have my answer. Whereas the moment you're in the chat realm, there isn't an expectation that there will be follow-ups, right? Because that's how chat works. I don't just go on there and say onto Slack and say, hey Pete, how are you? And you return, I'm fine, and then that's done, right? We're finished. That's us for the day. You know, there's a chat. The chats have multiple stages, and I write something, you respond, I respond to that, and so on, right? And so there's a whole paradigm here that is putting people in a different state of mind. And so it's I guess the point is that we wouldn't be having this type of conversation if the primary means of transmitting the output of large language models was the way that Google currently does it, because that's a totally different problem. You know what I mean? I think what all we're getting to here is this is nuanced, right? So I sort of feel like we're in slightly tricky territory, and I want to keep us slightly more focused on what we know, right? We know. And so why is it that using anthropomorphic language to describe what models do, why is it wrong to do that, right? So here's a couple of things, right? So I could say the model knows what a carburetor is. I certainly don't. So I might want to know that. I don't. But I might. The model remembers or learns. The model figured out. The model thinks. The model understands. You know, the model helped me and so on, right? Yeah. These are the things that you might say after or during an interaction with an LLM, right? And so what's wrong with that? Well, from a perspective of conveying a sentiment I have, I asked ChatGPT what a carburetor was, and it told me because it knows what a carburetor is, right? You understand what I'm saying. I've conveyed some information to you in a fairly discreet way that that you, there's no sort of questions here. If I went to my car mechanic and I said to you, I went to my car mechanic and asked him what a carburetor is, and he told me, or she told me, right? You would say there was nothing particularly controversial here, right? Job done. The problem we've got is that the model doesn't know what a carburetor is. That's why things get a little bit tricky. The car mechanic, I really do hope, knows what a carburetor is, right? Assuming I haven't got a Tesla, right? I took your carburetor out, mate. It's a Tesla. So the point is, why does it not know? And the second point is, why is it bad to think that it does? So why does a model not actually know what a carburetor is?
And we're going to get into, well, what do we mean by no?
Well, that's the point, isn't it? Right? So a model is a mathematical entity that is a bunch of weights which relate to a very big interlinked neural network whose job it is to predict what the next word is given a certain context. Right? So the context being, I've asked what a carburetor is, and it's responded, it's going to just say, a carburetor is a bit of a car engine that does X, right? And so we, even if we remove the, thank you for asking that question, Alex, here's what I know about a carburetor. No, it's just going to say, a carburetor is X, right? I would still report back to you that the model knows what a carburetor is. Right?
Yes.
But actually, all it's done is give me a response to my question that is the most likely sequence of text tokens, and tokens by which we mean, in this case, words, mostly, right? What it's saying is, here's what a response to that will generally look like. Here's what a response to that question will look like, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't know what a carburetor is. It's just a probability machine that can predict the likely response to that. It has encoded no knowledge whatsoever.
And it's interesting because they can sometimes be, well, yeah, there's large overlaps there. But it's doing a probabilistic, you know, prediction. And how did it get those probabilities? Well, it was trained on lots of text, which we might also call knowledge. So it's had lots of books. And if it's had enough books thrown in that detail exactly what a carburetor is, especially if that language is quite common, then the next predicted word is going to be, you know, quite likely what you would find in a book, as in quite likely what an actual carburetor is. And hence, why when you ask questions often comes back with the right answer, because it's been trained on a lot of data, of which is facts and knowledge, and that facts and knowledge, it's had multiple copies of that all say roughly the same thing. And so therefore, when it predicts the next word, it's highly likely that that is actually the thing. But the difference is, it's not like picking up the book and looking at a carburetor and, you know, this was written by a guy that took it apart and knows exactly what it does. It's giving you the remnants of many books, and that the likely next word is that. Now, the overlap, you know, and as we see as these models get better, the overlap is pretty large there. But because it's probabilistic and because it's not giving you actual knowledge, it can also be wrong.
There's a whole bunch of paradigms here that are not new, that are confusing things, right? So if you come to me and ask me what a carburetor is, before chatbots existed, I might go to either, you know, my Haynes manual, or I pick up or go to Wikipedia and I'm going to look it up, right? And in the same way that, and that answer one hopes is correct, right? And in a realm where, I don't know, I've signed up to a website, like a social network, and it knows my date of birth or whatever, or my gender or something about me. The most people probably think about it consulting a database or a big spreadsheet. It's like, here's in the background, there is a big sort of lookup that has a list of facts. It's got Pete's birthday and it's got my birthday. It's going to go along until it finds your name, read across and find your birthday, right? I don't think people necessarily visualize it in their brain like that, but most of the existence, for example, of the internet and technology in general, with regards to facts, I think most people just think of something like a database, a big store of information that computer program can go and look things up. And even prior to that, you would go to the library, right? What is a carburetor? Yeah. Well, the books on car, the internal combustion engine are over there. You might want to look in this section. Here's your Dewey Decimal, right? And so that there are facts there that are being consulted. And I wonder that a lot of people still think that's what's going on, right? That yeah. When you ask ChatGPT what a carburetor is, it's going off and consulting a database, say, right? And I think we're in good territory there if that's what's happening, because we assume that the entry on that is correct. Right? It's pointing you, it's gone and looked at Wikipedia for you, which it might actually do in the days. Now, we're in agent territory, but it probably won't. It probably just fishes it out from its probabilistic, you know, it's really hard not to use the word memory here, right? This is exactly where we're at. And so I think people think that it's fishing out facts. So when it goes, a carburetor is a type of duck, right? Well, I don't think there's a species of duck called a carburetor, but who knows? That you're going to be, well, that's wrong, right? I know it's a part of a car engine. And you go, well, did it just look across the wrong row or something? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so having consulted the wrong Wikipedia page is one type of problem, right? The type of problem that results in AI hallucinations is not even in the same fucking sport. It's not even the same ball game. Not let alone the same ballpark. It's just not the same problem at all, right? From a computing perspective, the problem of AI hallucinations and the problem of a bug that results in a computer program consulting the wrong entry in a database table are so hugely different, right? That they're not even in the same, you know, sort of intellectual construct. But I don't think most people are aware of that at all, right?
Yeah. And, you know, and there's definitely an argument here that says, well, if you get the right answer back, who cares anyway?
Yes, to a degree, but I think, that's a different conversation to me, right? And actually, I think we tackle that conversation quite a lot, right? That when we've spoken in the past about, you know, personalized software built by language models, we make the point that if it works, it works, right? You know, there are problems with doing things that way, but if it works, it works. But that's not really the issue here. It's the fact that you're misattributing something to a remote entity that isn't the case. So perhaps a better example then is that ChatGPT knows me, right? So you pointed out earlier that it will sometimes adapt its speech patterns and its vernacular. Again, speech patterns. The vernacular that it uses to address you over time. Perhaps it knows something about you that you like football or something, right? And it's saying, you know, things over time that lead it to believe it knows which team you support, blah, blah, blah. So this is what will happen if you use the ChatGPT app, right? People think then that the model has remembered something about them and that the entity that is constructing the sentences in response to the things that they says now has some knowledge about them, right? Which is entirely, absolutely not the case. The software entities that surround, you know, we're talking about the ChatGPT, you know, iPhone app or Android app, literally stores items of information about you and sends those in real time to the model, because the model has no memory at all. Once the model is deployed onto a server, when you interact with it, you do not change that model at all, ever. Everything it knows about you is sent at the time that you send that. And it's not even the chat chain. It's not remembering what you've said. The local application creates a log of everything that's been said in that chat and sends the whole log to the model every single time. So there's no memory there at all. Right? That every time you interact with a model, it is encountering you for the first time. Even if you hit the same, exact same computing hardware entity, the same server, it's interacting you with you for the first time. It has no memory whatsoever. Right? Yet the applications that surround it give the impression that it remembers you. Right. So not only is it in addressing you like a human, not only is it ferrying back and forth facts about the world, it's also supposedly adapting the things that it responds with to things that it supposedly knows about you. So this is one step further. Encoding in that model is some knowledge of what a carburetor is, right? Not knowledge. Again, how the fuck do you avoid this? The probabilistic weightings that relate to things that might be said about a carburetor, right? That's in the model, right? But if you're interacting with ChatGPT and you're just a normal person, you don't have any presence out there on the web, it's responding to stuff that's been given to it in real time. That's not even coming from inside the mathematical entity of the model. It's not ferrying out some probabilities that it had prior knowledge of. It's responding in kind to things that it's been sent in real time, right? So it's one step removed from the type of knowledge that says, well, it knows when Elvis Presley was born. It also knows when I was born. No, there is some probability within the core model about Elvis Presley's birthday, but there is none about yours. None. It only knows that because it got sent that when you sent the last message, which probably just said hello. And then the app that surrounds it picked up the fact that this is your birthday, sent that at the time, right? And that model has seen you. And every piece of knowledge that it knows about you is what was sent when you said hello as context with that message to the model.
But of course, what's interesting about that is in terms of your interaction with it via the chat, you know, the chat is doing all of that for you. The chat is storing previous conversations. It has, in inverted commas, facts in a database, in a lookup database, and it is passing that onto the model, which then is using that information.
Might be facts as well. So we can be a little bit more, a little bit more generous here, right? And let's say that the facts that the GPT app is storing about you are exactly verifiably correct, right? Mm-hmm. So in this paradigm that I was just talking about, where you go and get your fact from a database table or from Wikipedia, this is similar to that. So actually, on one side of this, the stuff that's being sent to the model might well be absolutely verifiable facts. Now, what the model does with that is a slightly different question. But we now have a mix of things that's going on. So a mix of the old paradigm, here's some actual verified information from a table, right? Sent to something as a probabilistic entity that could do any number of things with it.
From the end user's point of view, that's completely invisible. And so, therefore, does it have memory? Should I say it remembered who I was? It remembered my chat from yesterday? Well, that seems like a perfectly plausible sentence to me.
To a degree, and this is where things get really blurry, because if I told you when my birthday was, right, you probably wouldn't remember. Do you know when my birthday is?
No, I'm going to guess it's August sometime, isn't it?
Way! So you did store some of this, right? Because I have a clue when your birthday is. Not a fucking clue, mate. Although I probably experienced your birthday many, many years. I could not remember. But then these are precisely the sorts of bits of information my brain is not good at remembering. So, but, you know, just talk about a normal person for a second. So you've stored some of that, the August part of my birthday. My birthday is the 6th, right?
Okay.
But you haven't got the 6th part of it. Right. But you could choose to write that down. Right. So when I said to you just then, when was my birthday? You're like scrambling around on the notes on your phone going, shit. When is it? I haven't got a fucking clue when yours is. So the point being there is it's not such a different process. Right. So most people don't, you know, you don't remember everyone's phone number. Right. You may remember your wife's phone number or your daughter's phone number, but like I doubt you've committed mine to memory. So you're going to use some other method to fish out that information. And so I guess there is yet another human-like paradigm here in that what the app that surrounds this does is the equivalent of the smartphone in your hand, is that it's providing a bit of scaffolding to prop up the fact that the computer brain isn't perfect. Sort of ignores the fact that the computer brain can't remember anything until it's completely retrained, right? Which is a bit like saying the only way you're ever going to remember my birthday is if you get a new brain. You become Pete Mark II.
Well, so, and the thing here is that as these, I'm not going to call them the models, because as the software progresses, you know, the interfaces, they're adding more and more things in now. We know MCP servers have arrived and tooling has arrived in the last year, you know, which is, you know, fueling agents. And what we mean by that is that you can create a deterministic function, which a model can then call, you know, and we've seen this in what's been going on in the last couple of years. You know, they were so awful with numbers to begin with, which is what you'd expect, because it's not they're not dealing with numbers. The model isn't dealing with numbers like numbers. They're just trying to predict the next one. And you think about, you know, there aren't that many numbers, zero to nine, and the number of combinations of those. You know, when you say, oh, what's X times X? Well, it's either not seen that because two numbers are a bit random, or it's seen them in another context. And so it's all just, you know, who knows what's coming back. But what's happening a lot more now is that they've been trained to say, oh, well, don't deal with numbers. You know, we've got some tools for that. So if someone asks you, what's X times X? Then actually call this function, and this function is a calculator function, which is deterministic. Give it two numbers and it gives you back same answer every time. So it goes and uses that and therefore now gets the answer right. And there's more and more of that coming in as people write more and more tools and skills and functions, which are discrete deterministic bits, which say, you want to know what a carburetor is? Go here. Here's the information. You know, don't do anything else. Always come here for that bit of information. And so therefore that becomes, you know, a deterministic. You ask for that, you get this every single time. Every single time that it calls that tool, and, you know, and they're getting better at calling the tools more consistently because then they get rewarded for it. So next time around, they're more likely to do that. So therefore you start to surface more facts. So that blurring, you know, with the advent of agents and these skills, is going to happen more and more. And again, from an end user's point of view, all you really see is the latest version of ChatGPT seems to be better.
I mean, there's so much here, actually, and we've been going for nearly an hour, and we haven't really even scratched the surface on, like, why this is bad, right? But because there's so much about what's happening here, because we haven't even touched agents, right? So there's this difference between a chat session that goes to and fro asynchronously to an agent, which will go off and do stuff, right? And it could be do some research. It could be, you know, move some files around on a computer. It could be writing code. And its ability to test that code and so on, the agents are able to do tangible things, to change the world around them. And so there's a whole conversation, obviously, around that and the difficulties there and the benefits. But it leads to further anthropomorphization in terms of not, you know, that this model supposedly knows things and then it does things. And then it's, you know, the world has changed and then that model has some immediate knowledge of how the world around it's changed and leading you to sort of think about it as an entity with agency, right? That not only you know, has some supposed knowledge, but has sort of opinions and can make decisions on things, right? Because which way shall I code this? I'm going to code it this way, and then I'm going to test it, and then I'm going to change how I did something because this hasn't worked so well. You know, there's all sorts of what we would call decisions being made by an entity that's merely predicting the next token, right? There's no decisions being made there, right? It just had more information put into the current context that has led it to take different actions. But it's so hard to even talk about this stuff without at least, you know, referring to it as an entity with agency that thinks and is doing as taking decisions, right? We almost lack the vernacular and the vocabulary to do this any other way.
I mean, you get into the realm of making decisions, and then, well, now you've got to break down decision making, which again, we're into the territory of, well, most people have no idea about how they make a decision. You give me this, you give me this, and I make a decision to do it, and I have a certain amount of rationality around that. And well, let's break that down. And then there are some arguments here, I'm sure, you know, around, but well, is that any different from what the model's doing? He's like, well, I think it's different, but, you know, there might be some.
You get into philosophy. And that's the other problem here, is that it's hard to have this conversation without getting into philosophy and psychology and sociology and lots of other ologies, probably biology while we're at it. And it's such an interesting area because it's so broad and so sort of viscerally, you know, salient and really hard to get around. And we haven't really touched on why it's bad to anthropomorphize. And I can't. My head is hurting. Right, we're gonna have to stop because like also I'm like, oh god, we've got to cover all this stuff. And I've got this. There's a research paper, but we both consulted a bit before this. There's lots of research papers, and even the citations on this are pages and pages long, called De-anthropomorphizing AI from wishful mnemonics to accurate nomenclature. From wishful mnemonics to accurate nomenclature by various authors. That's just one paper that popped up in my timeline that I thought actually would be interesting. I've read it, skimmed it. There's some interesting stuff in here, but like almost every sentence is like you could almost just, you know, write a research paper on that alone. Interesting paper. It's worth a scan. It's quite big. There's so much going on here that makes me want to go off and do like research and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think in essence, the downsides are, you know, by projecting one thing onto it, you know, and we talked about how, you know, it doesn't remember and it doesn't know. By projecting that and using the heuristic shortcut of language, saying, oh, it knows this, then leaves you susceptible to making mistakes and leads you into more and more thinking about it as, you know, as some sort of human entity. And, you know, and we make so many assumptions about, you know, human entities, and you end up, because it can do this and seems to remember me, therefore it must be able to do that. And now I start treating it like it can do that, when really it can't. And of course, these models are very good at making it look like they can. And that's where you start. And I think that's the real downside, you know. And the obvious one here is, you know, the projection of, you know, AGI, because these things predict well. Oh, well, it's the first step of general intelligence. Well, it certainly appears intelligent. You know, I'll give everybody that. And in some instances, you know, like I said earlier, well, who cares whether it's one way or another? But, you know, when you start talking about intelligence, you've got to be way more, you know, detailed about it than that, and just projecting on, oh, because, you know, because it can now do this now, and it's learnt, you know, at this rate in the last 2 years, therefore it'll be running the world in 2 years' time. You know, so, well,
oh,
I think that's the bias, that's where, you know, that's where it leads you. And I don't think they're good statements to make.
Well, just on that paper, a few of the the risks outlined is misplaced trust and over-reliance, which is a version of what you just said.
Yeah, absolutely.
It did this well for me. So this adjacent thing, you know, or it'll always do this thing well, or it'll always do all things well, you know, because it can do this one thing, it must be, you know, it has a certain amount of intelligence, therefore I can rely on it to, you know, to do other things. So there's that, the over-reliance, there's trust and accountability, which is linked to that. And also there's the spillover and effects of overestimation, because it's good at thing A, it could also be good at thing B. And some of these assumptions are not unreasonable, right? If it wrote this algorithm well in Python, or this application in Python, it's not unreasonable to think it'll write a similar one, right? But I think, you know, I think the problem is much deeper than that, in that we're talking about things that, you know, can converse with you as if they're a human and seem to have agency and knowledge that could give you advice about things. And that's when we spill over into, you know, models telling people to kill themselves and stuff, that you start to trust these things because they seem competent in certain areas, and thus therefore trust them in areas that have far more sinister or far-reaching impacts, where you've got no reasonable reason to believe that they would. And I think it's also worse than that, because the models know about, well, the models can give you responses on so many different things, right? You know, you don't go and ask your car mechanic how to make cheese, right? Whereas you do go to GPT and ask it, what is a carburetor and how do I make brie, right? And you'll get probably quite good answers on both those things. And therefore you start to, this is where the omniscience thing comes into it, that you start to think, well, if it's good at understanding car mechanics and it's good at cheese, perhaps it's good at, you know, the philosophy of consciousness, or perhaps it will give me good advice on my investment decisions, right? And it's sort of hard not to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we've got to stop. I'd love to revisit this one, but I say that about everything that we do. So, what, you know, I'm like a like a model myself. I just regurgitate the same shit over and over again. I want to talk more. It's like every message you get back, GPT is particularly bad for this. It's like leads to another prompt to you know, yes. Would you like me to do this? Here's the answer to your question. Would you like me to extrapolate, or would you like to know more on this subject? And I constantly want to say, no, fuck off, right? Piss off and leave me alone, which of course it will do if I just don't respond.
Wow, this is an unfolding conversation, I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll come back to it. This one for sure. We should try and have a whole conversation, right, where we don't use any anthropomorphic terms, right? Like pick a particular area of AI and try and have a conversation about it, and like almost like rig up, you know, those electric shock machines they used to use. And every time one of us uses an anthropomorphic term, we get zapped and see how damaged we are by the end of it.
Yeah, see how quickly we learn.
Yes, indeed. Right, okay, well, that'll do for now. I'm going to go off and have a chat with my chatbot about the meaning of life. Right, well, thank you. Thank you, everybody. Cheers.
Bye. The confusion matrix.